Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Colin McCann, whose latest novel is Transatlantic. Earlier novels include Let the Great World Spin, Zoli, Dancer. There are 8 books in all. Colin McCann is the winner of the National Book Award for Let the Great World Spin. This is our 3rd interview together. We talked about Zoli and Let the Great World Spin. It seemed to me that Transatlantic kind of grew out of thoughts involving Let the Great World Spin, which was a look at how 9/11 affected all of us and kind of violence. And in a way, this does the same thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, but initially, Let the Great World Spin, for whatever reason, was very successful, and I was very lucky. But I was terrified. I mean, I was literally terrified, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I started writing a contemporary novel, of all things, set in New York in the present day. It was actually called 13 Ways of Looking After the Poem. You know, the 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of insinuations or the beauty of innuendos. Anyway, the thing was, that was a complete and utter failure. It was awful. So at the back of my mind, I always had this image, you know, of Frederick Douglass in 1845, still a slave, going over to Ireland to go on a lecture tour, an abolitionist lecture tour, and I kept trying to come back to it. I'd be in Manhattan in the present day. You know the way you get corralled by an image and you're just taken, and you're not going to shake it until you write it out of yourself? And I don't know why it was, but it did. The structure of the book then started to begin to look a little bit like Let the Great World Spin.
That image of Frederick Douglass in Ireland, how did you know that he'd been there? I didn't.
A lot of people didn't. It's not a thing that was written in our cultural memory. I mean, I remember growing up in Ireland in the early 70s, and if you saw a black person on the street, you'd be astounded. I mean, there was a few, like the Phil Lynott from the band Thin Lizzy. You know, you'd see him walking around Dublin, and every now and then there was a lot of young surgeons, young African surgeons, who were in the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin. But you wouldn't see many people of colour, if that's the correct expression. The fact that Douglas went over there in 1845 is astounding, and why wasn't he part of our larger memory? Academics began to talk about it in the late 1990s, early 2000s.
And how did you hear of it?
Just one of those odd little things that I said, oh, that's incredible. I think there was an academic conference and somebody gave a paper about when did the Irish become white? Which is an interesting question, because we weren't white in the 1845s when Douglas went over there. The Irish were considered third-class, fourth-class citizens, especially by the British establishment at the time, which was the establishment that sort of invited him over, which is where his huge sort of crisis of conscience. He said himself, I am here under the emerald skies, the bright skies of the Emerald Isle, and lo, the chattel becomes a man. For the first time ever, he felt free. But the contradiction was that he felt free in a place where the famine was unfolding at his feet in 1845 and 1846. I was astounded by the lack of writing about him. And then it began to strike me that maybe he didn't enter, you know, our grand public narrative, because, you know what, he didn't actually engage with the Irish famine in any way. And I got a little bit annoyed at him. And then I began to understand that the reason why he didn't was because he was looking after his own people at home. He couldn't take on the weight of a conscience of a nation or yet another nation or yet another group of people. And once I figured that he had all these contradictory things going on at once, that he sort of filled up his suit jackets. He literally did. He was a dandy and a very beautiful man. You know, he was 27 years old when he went to Ireland. All the Victorian women were sort of swooning at his feet and wanted to have him to come to have tea in the parlour. So once I finally got that image and began working with it, I wrestled with it. It's only 40 pages in a book, as you know, but I wrestled with it for well over a year and a half.
Just that section?
Just that section.
And you didn't know what you were going to do with it?
I had no idea.
And then what happened? I mean, how did you begin to realize the structure of the book and that it would reside in kind of a generational saga?
I was dealing with terror and not knowing exactly where I was going to go. dealing with my anxiety, dealing with my, you know, and I hate that sort of stuff where writers go on about like how tough it is and all that stuff. I don't value it. I find it disingenuous, to, you know, because it's really tough to be a lot of things. You know, it's tough to be a garbage man, you know. It's tough to be a fisherman. It's tough to be, you know, a radio host. You know, anybody privileging their difficulty is not interesting to me. But, you know, I did not really know where I was going until one day I was running around the park. I'd always been fascinated by George Mitchell, the Senator George Mitchell, who in the late 1990s, 150 years later, went to Ireland on his own series of transatlantic journeys and brokered our peace process. And it suddenly struck me, because I'd been wrestling with this thing about Douglas. Like, I don't like it. I don't want it just to remain in the 1840s. I need it to come up against the present. And then I realized, but that's how it comes up against the present. It's like, it's almost as if this stuff is inside you. You know, Don DeLillo came to my class in Hunter College one time, and kids were talking to him about process. We're all obsessed about process, and they all know his books intimately because he's beautiful. And Don was like, you know, he wasn't able to answer what he did or how he did it, except at one stage he stopped in the middle of the whole thing and he scratched his head, and he sort of pulled his baseball cap down and he said, sometimes, I wish I could do his accent, I can't do his accent, but he said, sometimes I seem to be the benefactor of an occasional revelation. And that's what it is. It's like solving a problem in complex mathematics. You work at it and it drives you nuts, and then suddenly it comes along and it's eureka.
Colin McCann, then there's another problem. You come across this idea of George Mitchell, and suddenly you're working in an environment that a lot of writers would stay away from, which is the fictionalization of a character who's still alive and still able to meet you, right, and to comment on the book, which means the moment you got the revelation, suddenly a door is slamming on the revelation at the same time.
Yeah, except it's not, because I find that the fiction and the nonfiction to be absolutely one and the same thing. And, you know, I did it differently to say how a journalist would do. If I were a journalist, which I am and used to be, if that makes any sense, I would say, I'm going to write about Senator George Mitchell. I'm going to go interview him. I'm going to go to all the archives and, you know, I'll get all the information first, and then I will build my treehouse or skyscraper or whatever it happens to be. Instead, I wrote to him. He lives 10 blocks from me in New York. Dropped the letter off and said, I would like to try and imagine what the whole peace process was like for you. Because he had been 64 years old, he had a 5-month-old baby. I thought it was a brilliant story. And what is this man doing going back and forth to this country that he really has no allegiance to or any ties to try to broker a peace process after 800 years of slaughter? And what sort of incredible empathy and generosity would it take to do that sort of thing? So I wrote to him, and his wife wrote back, and she said, yes, absolutely, we like your work, and when do you want to meet the senator? And I said, well, I don't want to meet the senator. And so I spent the next 6 months imagining what it was like, and then I sent it to her. And she was really kind. She understood my process. He was a little bit like, I don't know if I want to be, you know, fictionalized, because I'm not a fiction, am I? And that's a complicated question. We could talk philosophy about, like, what is a fiction and what's not a fiction. Anyway, she read it 3 or 4 times, suggested, you know, he didn't wear brown brogues, he wore black shoes. I mean, that level of detail, it was gorgeous. And I got it forensically correct. And then he finally read it. And he said, well, how do you know all this stuff? And that was that was a beautiful moment when he said that. He said, how do you know that I went to Stranmiller's Tennis Club? I said, I didn't know that you went to Stranmiller, but I figured you probably did, because I knew he played tennis, for instance. That sort of thing. And his wife kind of humorously said to him, you have to do this, George, because, you know, you've written 3 books yourself and nobody's read them. It's time for somebody. Maybe they'll read them if somebody else writes about them. But he's a great man, a really great man.
Obviously, he never said to you, I saw this woman in a wheelchair.
Right.
Though she plays a crucial role.
Right.
At this point, had you connected the dots between the character of the maid in the Douglas story and the woman in the wheelchair? Were you connecting the dots as you were writing it?
I was trying to connect the dots. As I was writing Douglas, there was this maid who appeared, and she appeared more or less on the stairs. I call her Lily. I mean, there is a Joycean echo there, of course. You know, Lily the housemaid was literally run off her feet. But she was there. And what happened to me, it was one of my favourite lines that I've written in a long time. Douglas is just walking up the stairs, and this maid backs into the shadows, and he gets a faint whiff of tobacco from her. Oh, gosh, that's very interesting. Who is this young maid? And she was there. And then I had Douglas and I had Mitchell, and I also had Alcock and Brown between them.
You had written that section,
Actually, the Alcock and Brown, where they take a flight across the Atlantic in 1919, the first transatlantic flight, was the easiest thing for me to write. So there was almost 75 years between them, like 150 years of history. But then I knew it's not good enough. I actually talked to Michael Ondaatje about it, and I love Ondaatje. He is one of my all-time heroes. And, you know, I was interested in the idea of Divisadero, you know, that novel. And,
sure, I interviewed him for it, yeah.
Yes, and he's so beautiful. And he said to me, maybe you should leave it. Just leave it with those three stories. But I didn't think that I had done justice to either the fiction or the non-fiction just by leaving it. So I knew I had to embark on sort of tying them all together. And then I was terrified that I was going to make a twee and like one of these silly tapestries, you know, I have a letter tying things together, and of all things, because I really didn't want to be some sort of like contemporary Jane Austen or something like that. Unopened letter? I mean, come on, for Christ's sake, don't do that. Literally, I was telling myself that. But I'd go back in and try to get the letter out of the narrative, and it just wouldn't leave. Just suggested that it has to be there. Finally, when I opened the letter, I mean, literally, I feel like I opened the letter one morning. It was there for me, and it wasn't towards until the end of the novel that I literally opened the letter, that I breathed a huge sigh of relief, because it wasn't too big, and it wasn't too small. It didn't have a huge revelation, but it wasn't miserably, you know, paltry. Part of this, as you know, Richard, is like, yes, you have to be true to your artistic ability and to ideas and, you know, embrace mystery and all these sort of things. But, Jesus, I mean, a part of it is that you also have to entertain. You know, in writing books, you can't be so involved with yourself that you think that it's kind of like a fever dream just because you write it is good. Part of it is you have to get out there and you have to entertain people, and you have to give readers a chance to step into a novel and step out of it without telling them what to feel, but allowing them to feel that they've embraced a new sort of history or a new sort of idea, whether that be about what's fact, what's not, what's history, what's not, what's grace, what's not, all of these sort of things that sort of obsess me.
Colin McCann, that brings up the question, how conscious are you of various themes in a novel when you're writing the novel? Or is that something for someone else to figure out?
It's something for someone else to figure out. If you're too conscious of it, you bring a sort of paralysis to the work, because I think then you sort of tentpole it around an idea, and you just don't want to gravitate too much towards one particular idea. I think there's a lot of things written inside us that we want to write out that we don't necessarily know or acknowledge. I don't want to sound like New Agey, because I'm the furthest thing. I'm a realist, you know, I really am. But part of it is just not knowing what you're doing, finding out afterwards. So now I'm finding out today what it's about, sitting down, talking to you, exploring it. And I will. I'll have a revelation, and I'll steal that revelation, and the novel will get deeper and better for me the further I get away from it. But the fact of the matter is, that's what you want readers to do, too.
It seemed to me, in reading the book, that while the power of the book has to start with Douglas and Mitchell, there's a key element in the book involving a murder that takes place in Ireland later on in the book. Mm. And it seems to me, in retrospect, that that always had to be there, not simply because there's foreshadowing early on, which there is, but because it's absolutely necessary to see how violence affects people, even if they're not part of the violent world.
Well, you just gave me the shivers, because that is one of those moments. We launched this book, Belfast, a month ago. This is the first time that anybody has asked me about that particular chapter, which is probably the pivotal chapter in the whole thing, where all these families come together, and don't give too much away, and there is a murder, and there's that sense of violence. Because the whole time along, all of these different nonfiction characters have been trying to take the war out of the machine in different ways, whether the machine be political, whether it be moral, whether it be like literal in the sense that they fly this old bomber from Newfoundland to Ireland. And then suddenly, towards the end of the novel, you have the war like suddenly thrusting itself into the narrative. That was a pivotal moment for me. But there's something about when I looked over the novel again, there was an inevitability about that murder. Well, I don't know how it operates on a reader. How did it operate on you? Was it a surprise or?
Well, there was a slight problem, which is that I, for some reason, the pages slipped away and I saw the event before it happened, but I knew the event was coming because of the foreshadowing. I just didn't know the context. And in fact, it isn't until the very end of the novel that we do find the context.
Right.
At the time it happens, we don't know why the character is where he is
at
that moment.
That's right.
It was shocking, and yet we knew it was coming.
Yeah.
But again, I saw that
something
as pivotal.
Yeah, there's something beautiful. I mean, you read the first line of Ford's Canada. First, I will tell you about the murders, and then or about the bank robberies. And there's something incredible about like saying that up front, and then the whole novel unfolds afterwards. So many times people think that you have to hold off on the mystery. You know, you don't have to hold off on the mystery, especially in terms of narrative. Think of how we tell stories. If we're sitting down the pub or the coffee shop, let me tell you a story about how my father died. And there's something about that. Then you know the end of the story, but how are we going to get there?
I've noticed, for instance, in genre fiction, that's become more and more part of the story, which is you don't need to hold back. You have to give that information. Stephen King, of all people, is a master at doing that.
He is a master. Funny thing, I was in New York last week and walking along the street, and who's there but Mr. King himself, holding an iPad with the earphones in. And I went up to him, and he was like very wary about taking out the earbuds. But finally he did, because I was talking away at him, because I like him. I like his work. I like what he does. He's brave. A lot of so-called literary writers could learn a lot about entertainment from someone like Mr. King.
Did you tell him who you were?
Yeah.
Did he know your
story? He'd read Let the Great World Spin, and he knew that I'd just come out with a novel. We shook hands, said, talk for 30 seconds, and then he put the earphones back in. We both went on our merry way.
What that sequence also does, that moment of violence, is it tied me back to Let the Great World Spin and also to Zoli.
Well, I love the connection. I know writers who sort of turn up their noses at the idea of like interpretation. They say, I didn't mean that, or you know. So, but to me, that's the absolute beauty of it. If you can create a work of art, hopefully, first of all, it is a work of art, and then somebody else makes an idea out of it that you didn't even necessarily know or acknowledge, that is even more powerful than you wanting somebody to have an idea come out of it. So the grand mystery of it is that it wasn't necessarily there for you in the first place, but someone discovered it for you. So you're creating, like you're creating a work, there's a work of art that's like almost, you know, it's living, it's breathing and giving birth to somebody else's idea, which is great.
This happens in any book chat, you know, among people who've read a book, when they begin to see fictional characters and talk about them as if they're real. They're going to come up with interpretations that were never in the author's mind, presumably.
Well, see, what I love, I love this idea, you know, that the characters that you meet in a novel must surely be as real to you, if not more real, than all those people that we haven't yet met in the world. I mean, surely they are constructs if we haven't met them. Leopold Bloom, he's my favorite one. I clatter on about Leopold Bloom all the time. But my great-grandfather was alive in Dublin on June 16, 1904, the exact same age as Leopold Bloom would have been in the novel. How do I know my great-grandfather? Of course, I never met him. I only know him because I read about Leopold Bloom, and I walked those same streets with Joyce. That's fiction, supposedly unreal, making my grandfather more real for me. This blood that's literally moving through me right now, this very second, is informed by the fact of somebody's imagination. The imagination is much more real than so many other things that we have.
Do you feel the same way when you're writing or in the world of characters like Lottie and Emily, fictional characters in Transatlantic?
Yeah. I mean, part of it was liberating for me to be able to go from the sort of forensic truth of the supposedly non-fiction elements to the sort of freewheeling idea that this character can now do anything that she wants. But again, I still feel that, and maybe I'll step away from it. It's probably been my project for the last three or four books that I've been messing with the idea of, you know, the fictional and the non-fictional. And I think maybe I've taken it to its extreme now. But it was Clifford Geertz who said that the real is as imagined as the imaginary. And that, to me, you know, goes to the heart of how do we create history, all of these sort of things that are important, you know. And also, listen, for all the young people out there, or all these kids who mightn't have yet thought about it, what is our government doing? What are these corporations doing but creating quote-unquote facts that are essentially fictions?
As I was reading Transatlantic, on page 85, Frederick Douglass is thinking, and I want to know if this came from you or from Douglass, the essence of proper intelligence was the embrace of contradiction, and the recognition of complexity was to be balanced against the need for simplicity. And it struck me, my God, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nothing is simple, right? Especially the idea of simplicity. And people who write know that. People who create dance know that. You have to make it look simple and have it to be graceful. But also to be able to hold contradictory ideas, as F. Scott Fitzgerald said, in the palms of your hands at the exact same time. And he said two, but what about ten? And have all these spinning plates up in the air, as Douglass had at the time. But that's also a comment on writing as well, you know, to be able to make it simple and profound at the same time.
Colin McCann, when you divide up the book, the first section is real characters from the outside looking at your fictional characters. The second section is the fictional characters themselves.
Right.
And the third section is a contemporary first person.
Right.
At what point did that form take?
Well, first of all, there was the idea of Douglass. I couldn't get him. Then came Alcock and Brown, and they were easy. Then came Mitchell, and he was sort of halfway between. Then I realized, okay, there's three narratives there. Now, I got three fictional characters in each of the narratives. Let me tell their story. Now I have three and three. Looks like balance, but it's not good enough. I want to disturb the balance, and then I went to a first-person narrator, and it's the only time in the novel that there's a literal first-person narrator at the end. I also changed the dialogue marks. I give it literal dialogue marks rather than dashes. It has a whole different accent, a whole different feel to it. But can I tell you, actually, now I remember, funnily enough, there's a character that comes in at the end, 10 pages from the end. It doesn't give too much away. His name is David Maniaki, and he's a Douglass scholar who's living in Ireland, and he's from Kenya. Some of the novel came from the desire, 3.5, 4 years ago, to make it entirely his novel. And originally it was all going to be set in the present tense in Ireland, 2010, 2011, and he was going to tell the story about Douglass coming to Ireland and so on. And I sort of abandoned him, and then he appeared. And like when I was writing the last chapter, it's like, oh, that bastard, he's back. Thanks be to God. It just made sense to me that this guy came along. And you shouldn't do it, right? A writer should not be introducing a new character 10 pages from the end, especially a pivotal new character. But he was perfect. He came along like a big surprise, and he owns the novel in a way.
Why did you make the switch? Was it just not working in your head?
Just not working. Yeah. You know, you push, and then you find, you know, often the voice is heard so far into the actual work. I mean, part of it is like, you got to excavate until you find something. There's a part of you that's an archaeologist of some sort, and you sort of just say, I am going to go dig. I don't know what I'm digging for. But I know I'll find some sort of relic in there, and I'll take that relic out, and then lead me to other histories behind it. And sometimes you just know the music isn't working for this character. Let me write it differently. And then something happens, and the music is right. It is very, very much like being a musician. I can imagine, what is it like for Van Morrison to go in and do, say, Astral Weeks, or to do Poetic Champions Compose, or whatever? Does he have a grand, overarching narrative that he wants to do? No. He has a feeling. He has a gut feeling. And he goes in, and he says, okay, let's, you know, give me a glass of Coke to Roan or whatever, you know, and let me hear the guitar over there. And what he does then is he works and he works and he works and he feels it and he finds it, and eventually it becomes a song, say like Madame George or something like that, which is one of my all-time favorite songs and albums. But it's similar for a writer.
The title Transatlantic, was that always there somewhere in the back of your head, or is that something that came in as you began to see the threads?
It came in as I began to see the threads, but the minute I found it, I knew I had it. I mean, I have notes at home where I started like writing it all over the place, messing with the T, messing with the A. Should I make it transatlantic with a small A, transatlantic with a big A? Then I had transatlantic with a K, which was really stupid, but, you know, you just wanted to, you know,
makes it political.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Or, you know, transatlantic. But there was no French person in it. But the discovery of a title is a really sort of fantastic moment, because I do think names determine so much, you know. Names often determine fate. I don't know if this is true or not, but the way we name our children, for instance, there seems to be some sort of fate involved, or maybe we just ascribe the fate to it later. But once you have the title of a novel, I think that's it. You know that you're going to finish it. When I wrote Let the Great World Spin, I was looking for a title, and it's like, and a friend of mine was telling me, yeah, you know, the stuff that you're writing about. Tennyson wrote about pilots of purple twilight dropping balls of fire. And I'm like, Tennyson? I hate Tennyson. come on. He's like, why would I name a novel from somebody like Tennyson? I went back in and then read his poetry, and it's like, geez, this is fantastic. The line was there, let the great world spin forever down the ringing grooves of change. And I was like, that is perfect. Then I debated with friends, should I call it Let the Great World Spin or Spin or whatever it happens to be, but eventually it just found itself.
Colin McCann, I was struck by the section on ice farms. Mm. How did you discover that, and why did you choose to put that in the book?
This is just one of those things. I have a fairly normal middle-class life. I live in New York. I've got three kids. And one day, we went apple picking. Doesn't that sound so bourgeois, right? We went apple picking. We went up to upstate New York and chatting away with one of the farmers in the apple yard or the orchard. He was telling me, yeah, they used to do ice farming around here. And I said, what? He said, yeah, you know, back in the 1840s, 1850s, you see those huts over there? They're broken down now. He said, yeah, they would make ice in the lakes. And making ice is incredible, because you wait for a freeze and then you bore holes down and you allow the water to bubble up and make another layer. And I just thought, that's an incredible image. I knew that, you know, you took it away, that someday, too beautiful to not use it. And then when I started writing this novel, I said, ah, there we go. We'll just have her be an ice harvester or an ice farmer in Missouri in the 1850s, 1860s. But the incredible thing being that in America, without electricity, you could get ice in New Orleans at 100 degree weather, and you would show your wealth by having ice in your drinks in the middle of the afternoon. And that was all taken down the Mississippi River and all kept in sheds up north. Incredible stuff.
Even year-round?
Year-round. Year-round, yeah.
You also had a chance, because of the George Mitchell section of the book, to interview Tony Blair. Uh-huh. Now, was that a live interview?
Yeah.
Were you tempted? I know it's got nothing to do with the book. Were you tempted to ask him about Iraq?
I was. But, you know, one of the conditions of the interview was that I wasn't going to go there. Because if I went there, we would have been in bad territory. And I didn't. I told his quote-unquote people that it's not about Iraq. It's purely and only about the peace process.
And how successful has that peace process been now, where 15 years later?
15 years later, that's how successful it's been. I mean, we had one last kick of a dying horse in Omagh. There was a terrible bombing in the town of Omagh shortly after the peace process was announced. I didn't go there in the book because history will see it as the last kick, I hope. You know, it flare out every now and then. There will be riots, you know, this summer. There will be things happening about flags and issues of ownership and sectarianism and so on. And Northern Ireland still is a sectarian society in the Catholic schools, Protestant schools. But the fact of the matter is that they have achieved peace. And if they let it go now, it will be one of the greatest crimes that we could perpetrate upon ourselves. Worse than war, than starting war, is to lose the peace. It would be just it would be a moral crime, an immense moral crime if we allowed it to happen.
You also, at one point in an interview, equated Frederick Douglass with Obama. While we kind of see that, you know, lately what we've seen from the Obama administration in terms of surveillance and in terms of the march to a potential war in Syria is something else again, and I'm not sure. My feelings about it are just so thrown out of whack by everything.
My feelings about it are thrown out of whack, too. I still believe, I still admire, I think there are immense problems, and he is dealing with contradictions. Like, Douglas deals with these terrible contradictions. He is a man in Ireland being well-fed in the houses of the wealthy. He is still a slave, and he knows he has to look after his people at home, and he sees barges of food being floated down the river in Cork while people are starving to death literally at his feet. And he has to make a decision. What do I speak out against? And he doesn't speak out against what's happening in the famine. I think much of what Obama is going through is dealing with those incredible contradictions. Who knows what goes on in those walls in the White House? I do believe that in terms of his general principles, he is still a deeply principled and honest man, despite there's a lot of crap. Is he ever going to come out shining? And no, it's never going to happen. But he's done some very good stuff, and I think he still truly believes. And I say that in spite of the fact of what's going on with the surveillance, in spite of the fact of these whispers about Syria, in spite of Guantanamo, all of these things that have been disappointing. I'll tell you a quick story. My son was involved in a bicycle accident in Central Park about 2 months ago. Really bad. Smashed his head off the ground. He was in the ambulance. He was concussed. He got through it all right. They asked him, what's your name? He says, John Michael. How old are you? 14. What day is it? He says, Monday. And it was a Wednesday. They were a bit worried. And what school do you go to? Eastside Middle School. Who's the president? And he says, not Mitt Romney. And I thought, yes. Not only is my son okay, but he's absolutely bloody right. Not Mitt Romney. Not John McCain. Can you imagine what it would have been? So for all the crap that's happening now in this administration, let's always remember that who's in charge.
You said very, very early on that you didn't believe there was any line between fiction and nonfiction. Right. That creates a real problem in terms of multiple people understanding the same fact so they can have a conversation.
Right. Yeah, that's okay. The very fact that it creates a problem means that you've sort of opened up a sort of necessary wound. You sort of lift the scab a little bit and say, okay, let's talk about this. Fiction, the word fiction, doesn't necessarily mean to lie, as some people seem to think it is. You know, you hear all this stuff, fiction, lies, we're born liars. No, it's not about lies. It's not about lies at all. It means to shape. It means to create and shape. And it's all about texture. And this shape should be true to the elements of human experience, not necessarily true elements of human perception, which is what facts are. So I like the idea that we can question what is fact, what is real, by inventing. And who's to say that my imagination is not a physical thing in the world? You know, who's to say that what is going on in what I want to create inside my head is not as powerful as the protons and neurons that are firing at this moment in order for me to say something so ridiculous or profound. I think it's very important. And it could just be solely an intellectual idea, but it comes down to a social level too. It comes down to a political level. You know, you want young people, we want our kids doubting what's going on, thinking about these things. And are we going to accept that big plate of supposed facts? For me, it comes back to the idea of Colin Powell, many years ago, holding up a photograph saying, here is a satellite photograph from Iraq. And we know it is, because it is a literal physical thing, and it's chemical tankers. So he sends our kids to war because he says that inside those chemical tankers, could we see inside those chemical tankers? No, we could not. And there was nothing inside them. Right? He extrapolated a quote-unquote fiction from an absolute fact, and he manipulated the fact, which is so easy to do. So it is the job of, say, writers or fiction writers or poets or playwrights or journalists to question who it is who owns the facts, who it is who creates the facts.
There's two ways that I would look at it, one of which is that no matter what we do, we're always seeing the world refracted through ourselves. That's the first thing. So on some level, our truth has to be different from other people's.
Right.
On the other hand, we have to find commonality. But the other thing you bring up here is that you can have the same facts, but what binds them together is narrative. And that narrative, on some level, always is fictional.
Right, right. I'd like to talk for a moment about narrative and stories. I mean, I'm involved with a new organization called Narrative 4, which is a non-profit organization where we're bringing kids from all over the world, not to tell their stories, because there's lots of organizations that get kids to tell their stories, but rather to own one another's stories, to step into each other's shoes and exchange stories for each other. So we would get together. After a while, we'd talk and get to know each other over 4 or 5 days. And then on the fifth day, we'd get up in a circle of people and I'd say, "Hi, my name is Richard. And, you know, when I was 9 years old, I something happened." And you'd get up and say, "Hi, my name is Colm. You know, when I was 14, my father took me to a soccer match in England," and go from there. And you would own my story. And I would own your story. And the process is all about like a deep, what we call radical empathy for the organization, and getting kids to step outside of themselves. Because I'm so sick of people being like only involved with themselves and their own idea of the world. The real beauty comes in being able to think about what it means to be other. And that makes you bigger, it makes you better, it makes you stronger, makes you tougher, and also, I think, just makes the world a more complete place. The worst thing would be say that everybody has to do this, but to allow people a chance to do this sort of thing is very, very important. So narrative, how we choose to tell our story, and what story we choose to give or present to one another, is really the glue that holds so much of this stuff together.
Colm McCann, I understand Let the Great World Spin was bought by J.J. Abrams, and you're writing the screenplay?
Yeah, actually, I was just in L.A., and Mr. Abrams, God bless him, he's got a lot of other projects, but this one's really sort of near and dear to his heart. So hopefully it'll happen. I mean, you never know with movies. The miracle is, if a good book gets written, then that's great. Or a book even gets written, that's great. If a film gets made, that's kind of a miracle. If a good film gets made, that's definitely, definitely a miracle, because you got all the stuff about money. It's sort of diseased with money. And then you got weather, you got actors, you got producers, you got time, you got all these different things. And hopefully JJ will be able to pull together something like Let the Great World Spin. But he has a little project to do first, unfortunately, that he's doing before mine, which is called Star Wars. It's light years different, but really he wants to do something, you know, something completely different for himself. And that's why he's sort of shepherded the process to here. And I've written the screenplay, yeah. I don't know what it's like, but we'll see.
And Colm McCann, have you started work thinking about what comes next, or are you still in that fog?
We were talking earlier, the great 60s novel is sort of very interesting to me. There's also another story that's really in the back of my mind. It's the first time I've actually said it to anyone. There was Irish troops went out to the Congo in the 1960s and got embroiled in so much of what was going on there. That's a very interesting story to me too. Maybe those two ideas sort of braid together in a certain way. I'm not sure. It's the first time I've really sort of started talking about it. But you have to be careful by saying too much, because you can like sort of lose it as well. Not that anyone's going to steal my idea. I don't care. Go ahead, steal my idea, because we'll all do it differently. It's like, you know, publishers getting on to you. You have your deadline. Say, go ahead, fire me. So we'll see. We'll see. It'll be another couple of years, though.
You've been listening to an interview with Colm McCann, whose latest novel is Transatlantic. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.